Are you blind? True story. A few years ago in the state of California, an incident occurred involving an elderly woman who had been shopping at a local grocery store. When she was returning to her car in the parking lot, she noticed four men she did not recognize getting into the car. The woman immediately dropped her grocery bags, reached into her purse, and pulled out her registered small handgun that she carried for protection. She ran to the front of the car, aimed the pistol at the men, and began screaming at them at the top of her lungs. She ordered them to get out of the car and warned that if they didn't, she'd blow their brains out. "I know how to use this gun," she said, "and don't think I won't." The four men didn't hesitate. They threw open the car door, scrambled out, and began running away in four different directions as fast as they could. The woman was trembling from her experience, but kept her composure. When she was certain that the men were gone, she put the gun back in her purse, picked up her grocery bags, set them in the back seat of the car. She climbed into the driver's seat and decided to go immediately to the police station to report the incident. But there was a problem. The key didn't fit the ignition of the car. A quick glance around the interior of the car confirmed what you already suspect. She was in the wrong car. Her vehicle was actually parked four spaces away in the same aisle, in the same parking lot. She quickly loaded her bags into her own car and she drove to the police station to confess what she had done. She told her story to the sergeant at the desk, who couldn't stop laughing. He pointed to the other end of the counter where four very shaken men were reporting a carjacking by a mad elderly white woman. And by the way, the woman apologized and no charges were filed. It just goes to show you that things are not always what they seem to be at first. I'm sure all of us on some occasion have jumped to a conclusion only to find out later that we were badly mistaken. Now, you may not have pulled a gun, but you may have hurt someone with unkind words or gestures. Perhaps you've spread a rumor that wasn't true or failed to include someone in your circle of friends, all because we made a negative comment or a negative judgment. Like the woman in the parking lot, many of us have a tendency to assume the worst in people. Our attitude is, we don't think, we just know that we are right and they are wrong. In John 9, Jesus is making his way out of the temple. He had just completed a very nasty exchange with the religious leaders, in which he was accused in one encounter of being demon-possessed. He was accused of being a Samaritan. He was accused of being too young. And to top it all off, he was even at one point threatened with stoning to death. It was a frightening encounter. And the venom that was spit at Jesus was truly hateful. To avoid being stoned, as it was not yet his time for his death, Jesus makes his way out of the temple courtyard, followed immediately by his disciples. Now, I should point out just for a moment that there's debate among scholars whether this was actually the 12 disciples or just some other people who followed Jesus at that point. Nevertheless, as they're walking along, Jesus stops and he focuses his attention on a man who was blind. In fact, he was blind from birth. It was a genetic disorder of some kind. This description of the man was meant to indicate to us that he had a birth defect and that he had never, ever seen anything. This is a man who had not seen a tree or shrub or a bird or the sky. He had not seen the face of another person. And he was relegated to the only option he had in that society to support himself. He was begging on the streets. He was living off the charity of others. The result of this economic situation was that he was a man who lived in poverty. Probably he lived on the streets. The disciples notice Jesus taking interest in this man, and they pose a question. Question that's asked out of judgment. Why was this man born blind? Was it the result of his own sins or the sin of his parents? In other words, surely somebody did something wrong to cause this man's affliction. And this approach to suffering is likely born of the Ten Commandments, where it's recorded in Exodus 20 verses 5 and 6, these words. I do not leave unpunished the sins of those who hate me, but I punish the children for the sins of their parents to the third and fourth generations. But I lavish my love on those who love me and obey my commands, even for 1,000 generations. Some of the authoritative rabbis held that not only could the sins of the parents leave a mark on an infant, but also the infant, believe it or not, could sin in the mother's womb. The disciples are not necessarily being mean. They're simply expressing the common theology of the day. If something bad happens to you, surely you've offended God somehow. Genetic defects in infants caused the Jewish scholars great difficulty. Thus, they would blame the parents for the children's situation, or in the case of some parents, the blame was somehow shifted to the child. Although, how a fetus could sin is beyond me. I can't figure that one out. On the other side of the coin, if you were living a blessed life, you must have pleased God somehow. It was the commonly held belief that good and bad things were a direct consequence of a reward and punishment transaction with God. So when the disciples look at this man who was born blind, they judged him. They judged him and they judged his parents. Someone was responsible for this man's situation. Now I must confess that I was tempted to think that this opinion of the disciples was held no longer in our society. That is until I had the opportunity to attend a mission expo in 2008 in Toronto. It stuck with me for many years now. Rick Tobias of Yonge Street Mission, Neil Hetherington of Habitat for Humanity, and Tim Huff of Lake Patrol were the leaders of this particular mission fest. Among the many wonderful insights presented by this panel was the eye-opening conviction that we still judge people in poverty by believing that they're responsible for their own situation. Tim Huff, amazing man. He works with street youth, and he was talking about an experience of sitting with street kids on a site on Bay Street that's right downtown in the financial district of Toronto, and the kids were sitting there panhandling. And there was one young man there who always kept one hand in his pocket and the other one would be out in front of him like this, begging for spare change. In the time that Tim Huff had been sitting there, that young man had been spat upon, kicked by men in business suits, and belittled for not finding a job. Tim reports that these well-to-do folks, with every opportunity in life, looked at these young people sitting there as lazy and worthless and responsible for their own situation. I, too, was convicted of the fact that sometimes that's how I see marginalized people. I often make similar assessments. I also suspect that most of us do. Now, Tim watched this young man with a hand in his pocket endure abuse for several hours just so he could get enough money to go and buy a sandwich and a cup of coffee. That's all he wanted. It's a scene played out many times and in many places in every city and every town, including this one. Tim went on to say in his story that at the end, when they decided they were going to go and find that sandwich and coffee, the young man took his hand out of his pocket. And to Tim's surprise, the young man was missing all four of his fingers on the hand. He asked the young man about it, and he said that his father, in a drunken rage, had chopped his fingers off. And Tim makes the point that most of us would have our impression of that young man changed with just that one little piece of information. The point being that the more we know about someone, the more we see people as Christ sees them. If I were to ask you this morning to define justice, what would you say? Rick Tobias, Yonge Street Mission, pointed out that most people would answer with the dictionary definition, which reads like this: behavior of oneself or another which is strictly in accord with currently acceptable ethical law or decreed by legal authority. Justice defined like this is the basis of all kinds of television shows like Law and Order, CSI, all of them. The bad guys get their day in court. Justice defined like this is the way the Pharisees and the disciples viewed the situation of this man who was born blind. His condition was the just conclusion of his or his parents' sinful behavior. Justice defined this way looks at someone who's in poverty or homeless and decides they got what they deserve. Jesus, however, reminds us that justice has a second definition. Most of us don't know it. The dictionary also states that justice is rectitude of the soul enlivened by grace. Wow. Rephrased, we would say that justice is moral or ethical behavior governed by grace. When Jesus looked at the man who was born blind, God's view of justice shone brightly on that man. People who are governed by grace see the beauty and the worth of all people. The psalmist said that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, not just the well-heeled, the well-educated, the well-connected, but all of humanity. Tim Huff made the point that the reason we need compassionate ministries like food banks, like First Serving tomorrow night, is because there is no justice in our society. If we lived in a truly just society, and I mean a society infused with grace, the man born blind, the young man with his fingers chopped off, wouldn't be relegated to begging on the street or suffering abuse from strangers. Mother Teresa once said, "Let no one come to you without leaving happier or better." That's justice. The justice that God seeks in this world. So when Jesus looks at the man born blind, what is the just thing to do? It was, of course, to heal him. Jesus looked beyond the surface. He knew the man's story. He saw the worth and the beauty of this blind beggar, and Jesus sought to bring him to wholeness, first by healing him and later by redeeming him. Now, contrast Jesus' treatment of this man with those who knew him formerly as being blind, namely his neighbors, his parents, and the Pharisees. Nobody but the man himself. Did you catch this? Nobody but the man himself wanted to celebrate this great thing. Nobody. Instead, they tried to dismiss it as some kind of trick or perhaps an incident of mistaken identity. His own parents, oh, that's the heartbreaking part of the story. His own parents, who appear to have abandoned him to his fate and fearful of reprisals by the religious authorities, didn't even express one word of gladness about what happened to him. I wonder if this knife was the deepest in the whole affair. Instead, the parents, who must have wondered for years what sin they had committed or the fetus had committed to cause this blindness, now distance themselves from him. He's old enough to speak for himself. Ask him. Rick Tobias makes the point that we become what we celebrate. Wow. If we celebrate grace, joy, hope, and dignity, these qualities will be incorporated into our lives. What we believe is precious, we will invest ourselves in. For example, our children are precious to us, so we invest our resources into their care and advancement. The poor and marginalized are precious in God's sight, and therefore they need to be precious in our sight. I find it interesting that the man born blind is never named in this story. Did you realize that? He's not named by Jesus. The Pharisees don't call him by name. His own parents don't call him by name. In fact, the only identification we have of him is of his affliction, the man born blind. And I wonder if that's because John wanted his name hidden so he could represent all the people in similar situations, or maybe the lack of a real name is deliberate to show how justice had failed this man. With no name, he remains a person without importance in the world's eyes. Furthermore, as we read the story, we see that the Pharisees did not know who he was. Did you realize that? The religious authorities didn't know who he was. The man born blind was a stranger to them. The very people who should have known from the scriptures that God's justice is one of grace and that the poor are precious in his sight have never met the man who should have received their attention. Instead of grace, the man born blind receives nothing but harsh words, relentless questioning, and in the end is called a sinner, and he's tossed out of the synagogue. He's excommunicated. The religious leaders would rather condemn him and excommunicate him than embrace him and celebrate the grace that was expressed to him. And John is clearly making a connection between physical blindness and spiritual blindness. The one who was truly blind were those who failed or outright refused to see the truth. The truth that God's kingdom was expressed in grace and truth that we willingly and unwittingly contribute to the oppression of others. By ignoring the man born blind, by threatening him, threatening his family, by failing to celebrate the grace, and by excommunicating him, from his faith community, he was being oppressed. Rick Tobias asked us a question at the Mission Fest that has actually stuck with me for a long time. He asked how we, you and I, how we unwittingly oppress others. Actually, he went on to say that we all oppress others all the time. He gave examples of how cheap food and cheap clothing that we enjoy are prepared by people in other countries living in extreme poverty. Retailers pressure suppliers to constantly lower prices, which mean poor wages and unsafe working conditions in other countries. Economic poverty is the result of an unjust society, a society in which grace is absent. So the question needs to be asked in light of John 9, just how do we respond to our own blindness? Are we prepared to become people motivated by grace, or shall we remain tied to that first definition of justice, which is all about laws and regulations? It is a good thing God didn't act towards us the way that first definition of justice demands. If he had, we'd all be in big trouble. Under that first definition of justice, none of us is guiltless. The Apostle Paul writes, we've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Then he writes, the wages of sin is death. In the matter of God versus humanity, we are guilty and under sentence to death. It is the just response by a just God. However, as Jesus demonstrated throughout his entire life and continues to demonstrate even today, God chooses to apply the second aspect of justice in his dealings with you and I. Paul writes, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God in Christ shows his heart is turned not to condemn us, to condemn the world as the Pharisees tried to do, but rather to save the world. Is it not time for us to apply the same kind of heart to those we encounter in this community who need a justice of grace.